Please join me in welcoming David to our stage.
My name's David, and I'm an alcoholic. And I would like to start by thanking the group. It's it's an honor and a pleasure for me to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And these are not amongst my favorite things, but I do what I'm asked around here, and my sponsor used to remind me that when I'm inconvenienced or uncomfortable is when I'm growing most. And the second thing is I'd like to welcome these three young men that introduce themselves as newcomers to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what to tell you. If you're looking to get sober and stay sober, you're in the right building. There's a lot of people in here. I don't know a lot of faces in here, but then I do know one table. They came to do this, you know. In order to relate to me, you're not only going to have to be an alcoholic, but you're going to have a lifetime of probably feeling like you never fit in, and probably feeling like you're a little, you know, other people are picking on you all the time, and you're never getting what you want, and you want something that other people have, and you're always jealous about what the other guy has and why you don't have it, and you don't have enough money in your bank account, and your car's not good enough, and your girl's not good looking enough, or and you're too fat, and I was too tall, and you know, bottom line, from the very beginning of my life, is I just never fit in. I never fit in. I never felt like I did. I always knew that I was different, and it was always confirmed to me and my family that I was different. I grew up in a very dysfunctional family where abuse and irregularities were the norm. And you can do two things when you're like that. You can be rebellious and stick your feet in the ground and get in their face, or stomp out the door, or go shoot somebody, or you can take responsibility for it. And I chose the second part of that. I figured it was, they were mad because I had done something wrong. And I was getting beat because I had done something wrong. And then it was natural for me at that point to want to fix it. And it started a train for me of knowing early on that I was just, I wasn't like everybody else. We had five kids in my family, and I felt like that I was the only one that was screwing up. And if I could only be like, you know, my brothers and sisters, I wouldn't upset my parents so much. And I just knew that I wasn't like everybody, like, at least at that point, I wasn't like the rest of my siblings. And I was responsible for my dad's ear, his anger. I was responsible for the names that my mother would call me. I was responsible for the way my brothers and my sisters treated me. And I was 100% certain that it was me. And you know, I carried that. I carried that around with me as a child. And it wasn't until, you know, it wasn't until I started early, not early around this group, but I believe I was about 10 or 12, and I snuck out with a friend of mine, and we went out and had a quart of beer, and all of a sudden, I mean, the lights came on, and I just fit in. you know, and all of a sudden I just knew that I was different. And my world came together for me, and I didn't feel as insecure as and scared to death. I was just terrified of everything, and I just didn't feel that. And right then, I didn't recognize that it was alcohol that was had changed my perception about how I looked at myself. And I thought it changed how they were looking at me, how I was with my friend. And I thought, I was certain that he was looking at me differently. And it became a friend of mine. I woke up, came to the next morning, and I was face down in my own puke, and that became a very familiar sight for me for the next 25 years, because I was a type of drinker that I almost always drank into a blackout. I mean, I just don't remember, you know, the very few times that I didn't drink into a blackout. I came from, if you were in, you know, I'm not going to say it was Ozzie and Harriet, you know, from the outside looking in, my family, but it was, they were respected in the community. And it was very odd, you know, you'd go out, we would go out, we lived out on a ranch, and we would go out and everybody would come up to me and tell me how wonderful my mom and dad are, and my pants are sticking to the welts on my legs. And I'm agreeing with them, oh yeah, they're great, you know. And it was a very confusing time for me, but I didn't know that I was confused at the time. I just was certain that all of his anger and all my mother's disappointment and all my brothers and sisters' disappointment in me was because of me, that I was doing something wrong. And I did everything I could to please them. I tried in every way to act differently, to do things. For me, I would try to be a clown, and then I would get in trouble for that. I would go overboard with doing their duties. We all had duties, so I would do their duties to try to make them like me. And it started a series of events that I carried into adulthood. Just constantly seeking attention, constantly seeking approval, constantly seeking, you know, just if only they would like me, and if only they didn't look at me the way they looked at me, and I was certain they were all looking at me the way you guys are now. And you know, it somewhere after that, that first day that I drank, I can't say that I grew up in a rural town, south of Bakersfield, and I don't really recall anything out of the ordinary drinking while I was, I say attending high school. I mean, I was there physically, but I don't remember ever taking a book or opening a book, and I don't remember. I remember a lot of D's and F's, and you know. And then when I went through the procession line, I was one of the guys that they handed you the little black book, but it was empty. I don't know if you were, you know. I didn't quite get the apparently diploma. I did a lot of workshop, and I did a lot of auto mechanics, which we were talking about earlier. But I don't remember any other classes. And it's kind of funny, we're like, you know, in this internet age, we got the Facebook now, and I'm on Facebook, and I'm, you know, communicating with these guys that went to my little shit high school that I went to down south of, you know, Wheat Pasture. I mean, you know, come on. And all these people are writing to me, and I mean, I know I'm self-absorbed, and I can't, you know, remember people's names. Oh, shit. I tried to remember these three guys' names, and I couldn't. But all these guys are writing, and I don't remember any of them. I don't remember, like, you know, and I wasn't in a blackout. It was just like, I mean, the self-absorption and the, you know, being into yourself started early for me. You know, I was concerned about me, and I rolled out of high school in 73 or 74, I forget, and that's when the fun began for me, because I got out of the house and I left the ranch and moved into the big town of Bakersfield, and I was 17 and I was on my own, and the party was on, and I discovered free drinking and free will, and I tell you what, all those things that happened to me when I first discovered alcoholism or alcohol, just I could do every day now. Every day I could fit in. Every day I could go to a bar, and every day I could become somebody else, and every day I was certain that I was the hippest, slickest, coolest guy there until the next morning. And then the next morning I would be right back in fear, right back in, oh shit, what did I do? Right back in, you know, who saw me, what, you know, because my life was just a web of lies. First of all, I'm 17. I approached it was the world's largest produce brokers company, and I tell them I'm a UCLA graduate and I'm 21 years old, and they hired me on the spot. And I said, well, shit, lying and deceiving works great, you know? I said, this is cool shit, because it came really naturally to me to lie, and, you know, and I got the great job, and they give me a car, and the only thing I had to do is just, you know, figure out, I wasn't real good at math, I'm still not, but I had to figure out, you know, what year I was born, and just a few other little minor details, and 21 UCLA graduate. Why I picked UCLA, my sister was at UCLA, so I figured I knew a dorm room, even though it was a female dorm room. If somebody asked me a question, I'd been there. I knew where it was. It was kind of near Beverly Hills somewhere, and I was kind of hoping they didn't ask more than that. And lying just came and it worked. And they bought it. And they were just thrilled to have me. You know, and I'm going, oh, this is great. You know, and so there I was, 17 years old, had a job with the world's largest produce company, and they were happy, and I was like over the top. I thought this was just the coolest deal around. And so when you're 21 UCLA graduate, you're a big shot. You know, and I don't know if any of you have ever experienced what they talk about around here as big shotism, but I'm unique, and so I experienced big shotism, and in fact, I still experience big shotism, but it was, you know, a big part of it started to be at that point is where that started to take off for me, and the alcohol was working for me, because it took me, it rose me and brought me up to where I thought you wanted me to be. I didn't know. And brought me to a level that I thought that, you know, because I was certain you were judging me. I've said this before, I could walk into a room, I don't know, let's say 60 people, and if I was a bar drinker, so I could walk into a jam-packed full bar and see, you know, 15, 20, 30 people pat me on the back, good to see you, David, da-da-da-da-da. But if one person didn't say hello, or one guy I knew didn't look at me, or one special girl didn't look at me, that's what I focused on. I didn't care about the 35, 40 people that said they were happy to see me. I was focused on the one guy and that wasn't happy to see me, and what the hell can I do to change his mind and turn him around. So the dance started. You know, I would start acting a different way. I would focus on her usually. And and I would start acting and pretending to be somebody else. I was very good at that. UCLA graduate, I possessed a lot of skills. They developed shortly after that summer. Being a 17, well, I was 21-year-old doc, well, produce broker, I can tell you, it's a lot more impressive to be a doctor in a bar than it is to be a produce broker. I can tell you that. And so I discovered that. I discovered that being a doctor was like, you could get some chicks. You know, all you had to do is tell them, I'm a doctor, you know. And, of course, I had to do a little bit of research. I had to find what doctors talk about. And so I started that drumbeat, and I was bullshit, and I had perfected lying by then, and I got a little brazen with it. At one point, this table has heard this story, but I went to Mercy Hospital in Bakersfield, walked in the doctor's lounge, donned a coat, put stethoscopes, and made the rounds. Yeah. I bet you're all glad you weren't in the party. Give him another shot of morphine. Yeah. I did. I mean, you know, I found, you know, Dr. Kildare was on, and he would always go to bedside and pick the thing up and look at him, you know, so that's what the hell I did. You know, I just, all I remember is this one chick. She was younger and cute. She goes, damn. She goes, you don't look old enough to be a doctor. And of course, I'm 17. And I'm going, well, that was before Doogie Howard, but I invented it. And I said, well, I'm like really smart. And I got out of school early. And she goes, wow. She goes, can you be my full-time doctor? And I'm going, hey, this is working. And what it was doing for me was just like feeding this ego and feeding this insecurities and all the fears and all the, I wasn't good enough and I didn't add up and I didn't major and you're better than me, and it was working. And I didn't stop with the doctor. I was a banana plantation owner down in South America at one point. I think I owned an airline in Florida. But that was later. I think I was 19 by the time I got my airline. And like I said, I was a bar drinker, and I was hanging out in nice bars, and I was throwing money around, and shit, they didn't care. You know, I don't know if any of you ever drank in bars, but when somebody's buying your drinks, do you question them? No. You just say, hey, you're my buddy, you know. Keep it rolling. And that's what I did. And everybody, you know, I thought everybody loved me because I was paying for all the drinks. And when you're a UCLA doctor, graduate, plantation owner, you can do shit like that. And it was kind of a time of my life where I was away from home, and for the first time I was getting all these adulations, or I was forcing them out of people, but I was getting all this adulations and praise, and people were, I thought, admiring me. And it was just absolutely, that hole that was in me was just closing, and I was just filling it. And I just felt different, and I knew I was different. And maybe I was wrong about myself. Maybe I wasn't a piece of shit. You know, being a doctor, I'm with that. And so it continued on. And then by a set of fate, I fell into, completely fell into, because I had absolutely zero talent other than lying. I fell into an outstanding job, and now I'm like, you know, 20, and I fell into this just like, you know, once in a lifetime deal, and the business took off. I owned it, and the business took off, and I'm in my 20s, telling everybody I'm 25 or 30, no, 25, and the business took off, and now all of a sudden I was really somebody, you know. I didn't have to pretend anymore, and I was, the big book talked about being a big shot. Well, that was me. I had the big cars and the big this and big that, and by the time I was 30, I had driven the company into the ground. It was destined for bankruptcy, which, you know, 2 years later it would be, but here I was closing in on 30. It destroyed this beautiful opportunity, and I thought, how can I fix this? Marry a rich chick. You know? I mean, so let's find somebody who can support me, you know? And so I ran into this gal whose family had everything that I wanted to be. They came from a respectable family. They had money. I pretended I had it. They thought I had it. You know, 2 years later, I had literally filed bankruptcy and destroyed this company. And you know, I met this very nice lady and took her hostage, and it was, you know, I married her to prop me up, to make me look good, so I could feel different. Using her for my own self-image. There was nothing about love involved in it. I mean, I love her today. She's a great person. But it wasn't until I got sober that I could say that or recognize that. But I met her and married her, and my drinking, as I had a great excuse now, I had this wonderful company that was making, employed a lot of people, making a lot of money, was destroyed, and I developed a new term in my repertoire. It was if only. If only, you know, the market was a little different, this wouldn't have happened. And if only the bank had given me some more money, this wouldn't have happened. And if only, you know, I hadn't spent so much money on that car, this wouldn't have happened. I was one of those people that I was always looking at, you know, how much water was in the glass, how much money was in the bank, or I never was concerned about how the water got into the glass or how the money got into the glass. I was never concerned about the process. I just was looking at what's in it for me, what's the end result here, and how am I going to get it, and if you don't want to give it to me or be part of it, I'm going to look to steal it from you. And then I became, now I'm in my late 30s, and no, mid-30s, I'm in a massive bankruptcy, and I start on another path. This path was I had built some friends in the business, and so I conned them, and my line by now had honed itself into an art. I had become masterful at bullshitting and lying, and I started talking friends who had legitimate businesses and legitimate money. I started talking them into scams, and I took over the next late 80s, over the next 7 to 8 years, I built and destroyed 2 more companies. And along the way, I stole a tremendous amount of money from dear friends. And it was it was all about, you know, I had no regard for you. I had no regard for how hard you worked for your money or what you did for it. I didn't care. The only thing I cared about, what's in it for me. And what am I going to take from you so I can feel better about myself? And if only this would happen, and if only that would happen, I would feel better. And every time I looked at a phone, and I'll talk about it later, but I realized when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, when I'm telling you, if only, what am I doing? I'm taking no responsibility whatsoever for my actions. I'm saying, if only you would change, I would feel different. If only the bank would give me a little bit more money, I would feel different. If only my car wasn't a piece of shit, I wouldn't look like this. And it made me feel good, because it was all your fault. It had nothing to do with me or what I was doing. And I justified all of my actions. And now it's the mid-90s, and I don't know, again, I don't know if you're an alcoholic. The big book talks about a moderate drinker, heavy drinkers, and real alcoholics. Well, I'm here to tell you that I'm the latter. As I said, I drank into, I'm not a real good about, you know, around AA, I mean, it really doesn't matter what you say about how much you drank, because somebody's going to double it. But, I mean, I can tell you that, you know, I started drinking in places that had chandeliers, and then the next thing I know, the tables had those candles with the plastic wraps on them, you know, the round ones. I'm drinking in those kinds of bars. And then the next bars I'm drinking in have those Jesus Mexican candles on them, you know. And so I know I'm going downhill just by the candles, you know. I started out in the fancy bars around Fresno, Nicola's and Pardini's, and I disgraced myself in all those places, and they kindly asked me to find someplace else to take my Dr. Plantation roadshow, and so I speak Spanish, and so I. A natural place for me was the Mexican bars, and that's where I ended up in the mid-90s, and I was well liked there. They didn't give a shit if I was a doctor. They weren't impressed with that. They were impressed with the banana plantation thing for home meeting, but more impressively, I was buying drinks, and that's all it took. You know, I don't know if you were ever a bar drinker, but you can find friends fast when you open your wallet. Red Fox met his girlfriend, and they asked him. She was some young little cute girl, and they said, "Hey, Red, how'd you meet her?" And he goes, "I just opened my wallet, and there she was." And that's how I found all my friends. I just opened my wallet, and there they were. You know, and when my wallet ran out, so did they. And I poured through them, you know, and in that destruction, you know, I'm talking about destruction tonight of only companies. I'm not talking about the families that I destroyed, my own. I've been single all my life until I married in sobriety, 7 years ago. Well, no, I forget. I did marry at 30 for money, but we lasted about a year, and she saw what she had on her hands, and was smart enough to move out, and then I was never somebody who was really capable of, you know, it's a little difficult when you're on a date and I'm face down by 8 o'clock at night. You know, it's I'm not the really marriage material, you know. And so I spent my whole life single, and then by the late 90s, I'm if you're a real alcoholic, everybody seems to have those last 4 to 6 years, and I had them. And I went underground, and I started drinking around the clock. I discovered morning drinking, and then I proceeded to lose. I mean, I've already been through 3 bankruptcies, but now I've really lost it. Now I've got no car, I've got no home, I hadn't spoke to my family in 10 years. I'm just gone. And I've been arrested 6 times, I think, for drunk driving. I do not know how many times I've been thrown in a drunk tank. I've been in prison and Mexican jail. And so I've had plenty of brushes with the law, but I wasn't an alcoholic. And I was back east, and I don't know, I sobered up to try to go to work for a guy. And I had, in my blackout, I had packed a big book that somebody handed me in one of these court-appointed joints in the AA. And I said, oh, yeah, AA, I'll go there, hang out, stay sober, go back to work. And I came in here, and I'm not really proud to say this, but what I did is I came in and sat around and made fun of all of you. I looked and laughed and judged you all, and you were all completely less than me. I remember the first meeting I went to, I was in Jersey, and a guy comes riding in on a bicycle, and he's got this chick on the back, and between them they had 12 teeth, and he jumps off, and he says, hey, if you want what I got, and I'm like looking at her, and I'm going, I don't know what you have that I got, I've been back to Jersey, at least 8 or 10 of the 12 or 13 years I've been sober, and I see that guy, and he has everything. Today I know that he has everything I want. And how did I get to that point? I mean, I right after there, I started going to a lot of meetings. I had no intention of coming back to California and telling anybody, you know, that was anything other than a banana plantation doctor. But I was going to a lot of meetings and not court appointed. And I don't know. You know, I just remember I walked by a mirror one day in this room that somebody had rented for me. And I remember seeing myself in the mirror, and I remember thinking, what the hell have you done? That's all I remember saying to myself, what have you done? And that was my burning bush, that was my moment of clarity, that was my awakening. And I knew right then that I had to contact somebody at home in Alcoholics Anonymous and tell them what I've been doing and what I've done. And, or else I wasn't going to stick around. And I didn't know anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started thinking, I used to drink with this guy, and I heard he was sober, and I called him up, and he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, 13 years sober, and he was a psychotic, but he was sober. And I called him up, and he told me to start reading the first 164 pages and call him in the morning, and I'm going, how the hell do you know how many pages are in that stupid book? And it's like, you know, but he started me right away. Thank God. I always talk about my sponsorship and the men in Alcoholics Anonymous in Fresno that saved my life, because I came in such a liar, so full of shit, so full of myself, such a victim, that I looked impossible, you know? And I was, you know, everything was a lie. And he was just perfect. He was not in for any of my horseshit. And he said, you know, the only way I'm going to sponsor you is if, you know, I sponsor people that do the steps. You want a pal, you want a friend, you want something else, find somebody else. He says, I got plenty to do, I got plenty of guys to work with, I don't need a pain in the ass like you. And I took it as a challenge, you know. So I started doing everything he asked me to do. And I started, I didn't know what I was doing. I remember going to take my fifth step, and I had it on my lap, And the only thing they told me to do is write down everybody you're pissed off at. And I thought, cool. You know, I had like all these pages and stuff. I didn't know that I'm supposed to find out where I'm wrong. You know? And after that day, we did 5, 6, 7, 8. And I was about 4 months sober, 5 months sober. And it was at that moment that I earned, and I knew I'd earned my place in Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt that seat beneath me. And like I said, that was a little over 12 years ago, and I've never looked back. God was never in my life, and I learned that he better quickly get in my life or I was going to die. I needed to find a God that I could depend on. And I needed to find a God that I could trust. There's a piece in here that talks about exactly where I was, and I can remember what page it was. I don't want to look at it. Okay, this is talking about God when you're new, and maybe you don't completely understand it. And this is part of the 11th step, and it's saying that we need to relax, and it's talking about meditation. What used to be the hunch or occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Still being inexperienced and having just made the conscious contact with God, it is not possible that we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, become more and more on the plane of inspiration, and we become to rely upon it. And that's what my story was. I didn't have a God, I didn't know about a God, but I believed in what I didn't see. And then eventually I saw what I had been believing in. And then the actions that I was taking started happening. And so then I truly believed that everything before me pointed to something else. Now it's pointing to, I didn't want to be a banana plantation anymore. I didn't want to be a liar anymore. I didn't want to hurt people anymore. And this program for me really started right about there, in the middle of my amends and finding God. And getting square and starting to humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings, the 7th step. That humbly, it wasn't about the shortcomings, it wasn't about the character defects, it was about becoming humble. And I didn't have that ability. And with that part, I found a little bit of humility in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had nothing to do with it. I had you good people who have been around here, the more wonderful sponsorship that I've had, and these great people that are sick enough to ask me to sponsor them. And it's been for the new guys. If you want to get sober, they say you got to be willing, but you got to be willing to go to any length. You got to be willing to do anything. Unfortunately, in my experience, it's just not going to happen. Again, I ran over. He was worried I wouldn't have enough to say shit. He didn't know who he asked. All right. Well, anyway, thank you. And it's a great group. And I want to reiterate what an honor and a privilege it is for me to be asked and to be here. And have a good evening. Thank you.